Thank you very much, Teresa. It's a real pleasure to be here at the conference. And this is the final session on small learning communities. We're going to be looking specifically at a ninth grade academy. But I really think this is more than a ninth grade academy model. This is about teachers and administrators working together to create a shared vision of learning. So with that, we'll get started. Just a little bit on the agenda. You know, I'll be talking about things like leadership and planning, a big focus on instruction, talking to you a bit just about a sample program that I was part of, some of what we did as far as working with students, teachers, and parents. So that's kind of the big picture. I would like to just call your attention to my website, which is at peterpappas.com. And the reason is that I get about 1,000 visitors a day, and that's over 300,000 a year. And there is a lot of material there that's free, and you can just download and hit print. In fact, much of what I'll be sharing with you today will be available online. Now, just to give you a little bit about me, I was a high school social studies teacher for 25 years, had a really, rewarding career as a teacher, and relatively late in that game, I kind of got lured into administration and went back and took some graduate courses and ended up as an assistant superintendent of instruction. For many years, for about the last 15, 20 years, I've worked as a consultant, as a writer, as a trainer. I've had an opportunity to work all across the country. And for about the last 10 years, I've worked with Bill Daggett and the International Center. So I've done a lot of projects with them. Now, just to update you as far as the website, I'm audio taping this. In addition, it's going to be videotaped. I also have an updated version of the handout, and this is all available on my website at the blog section. So also, if you missed any of the other presentations, the handouts and the audio tapes will be there. I just have to get around to uploading them, which I should do very soon. A particular part of my website that you'll find useful is called Small Learning Communities That Work. There's the address, and it does focus in very directly, I think, on my work with both the ninth grade academy as well as a summer program that I developed for us academically at-risk students. And there's a lot of material there that you can just go take a look at. The other thing I would share with you is if I can be any help to you in your home districts as far as doing some training or consulting, certainly contact me via email. If you have any questions or just, you know, need some advice, I usually try and get around to respond. It's always a good idea if you put something in the title line, you know, I saw you at the conference, as opposed to something like low mortgage rates, which means I won't open the email. Now, to sort of change the flow of information a little bit, we've got these response units. Does everyone have one? Now, these are yours to use temporarily today. That means I want them back, okay? So we have to be very careful to collect them. But I thought it might be fun to integrate them into this lesson. These are courtesy of Turning Technologies, which makes a program called Turning Point. And what's really nice about this is it sits right on top of PowerPoint. You can just easily adapt your PowerPoint slides and gather response from an audience. The other great thing is if you're using it in a classroom situation, you can actually import the student database and do some on-the-fly assessment of kids, and you can know which kids are answering which questions correctly. You do not even have to display the data to the kids. You can just see it as the teacher, and it will all export into your grade book if you want to track it. But we're using it in a slightly different way here, just to sort of change our flow of information. So you've got a responder in your hand. I've got a question up here. Piano is to keys as trumpet is to, and I want you to just to select 1, 2, 3, or 4. And when you click, a little green light should go on that tells you that you made a connection there. And I'm going to just take a second for your responses to ring in. I promise you we'll have some more profound questions in a moment. Okay. Anyone else still waiting to respond here? You all kind of got in there? Okay, great. And we've got buttons and valves. Will any of the musicians in the audience want to tell us what the right answer? What is it?
Valves.
It's valves. Okay. And we are tracking those of you that pick levers and frets, and we will be I'll be sending that information on to your administrative team. Now, here's a more introspective question as to what you like to do when you go to a conference, okay? So will you pick one of the responses here?
Can you pick more than one?
Well, pick two if you want. Go on ahead. Be bold. Yeah, go on ahead. I think I have it set up so it'll take two from any one unit. Okay. And again, if you just make a snap decision here and pick one, we'll be in good shape. Okay, we're going to close the polls here. Let's see what we get. So, ideas we can use in the classroom, reflect on my practice. In this particular case, I think this workshop is very focused on kind of the more strategic planning. So I think the ideas that you're going to get won't necessarily be ones you might translate into your individual classroom. But certainly if you're giving some thought to creating a small learning community, I think these will be very useful ideas. Now, to kind of get us warmed up, we're going to play Survivor. Okay? Now, in your handouts, you've got a little Survivor section here. And this is the scenario. Okay? It is approximately 10 a.m. in August, and you've been flying in a plane that's just crash-landed in the Sonora Desert. Okay? Now, the plane burned, the airframe is left, the pilot is dead, but you are not injured. Now, the pilot was unable to notify anyone of your position before the crash. You're about 70 miles from a mining camp. You're 65 miles off the flight plan you filed. And you have 10 items on the plane. And what I would like you to do is start ranking them 1 to 10. With 1 being the most important and 10 being the least important. And the items you have, and you should find this, where is this on the handout? What page is it?
3,
okay. You have a parachute, a topographic map, Cher's Greatest Hits, which by the way is a 4-CD set. She had a lot of good stuff. You have a book called Edible Desert Animals, a handgun with bullets, a magnetic compass, a bottle of salt tablets, 1 overcoat per person, a flashlight, and 2 liters of vodka. So I want you to start ranking these on a 1 to 10 basis. And you can either do them individually, or if you want to work collaboratively with someone near you, it's kind of a neat idea if you want to take a few moments to do that. Hypothetically, if you thought the vodka was the most important thing, you'd put 1 in for that. And edible animals, if you thought that was the second most, you'd pick 2, whatever. But I'm going to let you do this, and so we're just going to pause for a moment here and allow you to try and collaborate a little bit with some people around you and come up with your list. I'm going to hit pause right here. I'm assuming you can edit this out, right? Of course. Why don't you work with someone else and see if you can get a little agreement on it? Because that's the interactive part, which I think is useful.
For the rest of them because
right.
There's no relevance to the order. I don't know.
Well, there actually is.
Is there?
There is a logic to this, yes.
Okay.
Trust me. And you'll actually get to vote on these. Okay.
I think they're far more.
And the flashlight.
How are we doing back here? Pretty good?
Yeah.
All right. Okay, well, what I'm going to do for the sake of time is I'm going to cut you off here because you could probably spend a lot of time doing this. And what I would like you to do is to use the responders. And again, if you worked in collaboration with somebody else, you both don't need to enter in the data. If you've got agreement, if you don't have agreement, then enter in your own. And I'd just like you to indicate your top three choices. Using zero for vodka if you, that's number 10, okay, because I don't have a 1-0. So again, if you just pick your top three choices, if you work with someone else together on it, you can only, you know, you don't have to enter it multiple times, okay? Yes, sir.
What year is it?
What, it's now. It's August, it's next week. It's, we're here. Okay, so has everyone got theirs entered in?
No.
Okay, come on.
Wait.
Okay. Come on.
Commit
to something. All right, the clock's ticking. We're going to move into Final Jeopardy where the value is doubled and the scores can really change. Okay, come on, your time's up. All right, so let's take a look. Well, we got the topographic map and the compass were far and away the top choices, along with the parachute. Now, I'm just curious, does anyone want to share with us what their plan was? Yes, sir.
Since it's this year, and the plane would have a black box and a global positioning device on it, help's going to be there in 2 hours anyway, so I got the vodka and I'm just going to wait.
Okay. So in case we missed that for our tape, he's going to use the black box on the plane and just relax with the vodka. Okay, someone else have a plan? Yeah.
Use the parachute as a signal.
Okay, use the parachute as a signal.
Yeah, try to make yourself visible.
Make yourself visible. Yes, ma'am.
I'm going to use the parachute for cover during the day, read the topographic map and compass, and I'm going to walk towards the mining camp.
Okay, so she's using the parachute as cover during the day and using the map and the compass to hike to the mining camp. Anybody else? Somebody have a different plan? Yeah.
I was thinking about his idea that somehow someone would know I was missing and using the CD for flash or shine reflection.
Right on.
Okay, so using the CD as a reflector to signal people. Now let me just put the question in a slightly different way. If you think about your primary objectives and the barriers to your objectives, what's the problem you have here? And what is your goal?
To get survival.
Okay, so your goal is to survive, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and what is the barrier to that goal?
Lack of water.
Okay, lack of water, location, desert, you don't have the right things. So the real question then becomes, what's the best use of your resources? Now, judging from the way people voted with the map and the compass, I got the sense that you were going to hike out, correct? How many of you were planning on hiking out? Raise your hands. Okay. Now let's leave those hands up there. Okay. Now, if you're an administrator, leave your hand up there. See, there's kind of a high correlation between people who want to hike out and administrators, I've found. And what's even more interesting is the experts say that hiking out is certain death. So, yes. So your administrative team may be leading you to your death because here are the experts' rankings. And this, by the way, is taken from a desert survival exercise. It's got some authenticity. The number one item was shares greatest hits because it's a signaling device. The number two item was the overcoats because they really protect you from the warm, moist air, from They protect your moist body from the dry air. That's why desert people layer up. The flashlight is a night signaling device. The parachute, of course, makes you very visible, because what the experts say is stay put, and because of global positioning and because of the fact you didn't get there, they're going to start searching along the flight plan, and they're going to keep looping out and, you know, until they see you. And, of course, if you start hiking off, you get to be a little small speck on the desert. So stay put under the parachute. Of course, the handgun has some positives because it's a signaling device to make noise. The downside is, as you dehydrate, you become delirious, and you're likely to shoot somebody. The magnetic compass isn't of much use to you at all, because you really shouldn't be hiking. The topographic map, for the same reason. Edible animals of the desert. How many of you were worried about getting hungry? You were going to chase around little bunnies and things to shoot them. Yeah, how long does it take to starve to death?
Long
time, yeah. Forget about that. I wouldn't worry about that. The vodka, of course. We do have some partiers out there, but that's a dehydrating agent, as is the salt tablets. Now, I sort of suggest this as a, because I think it has some implications for us as school planners, as planners of programs. See, I think it's important that we clearly identify our goals, that we define them, that we look at our barriers, and then we talk about allocation of resources. See, unfortunately, what happens in education is we sometimes rush to structure before we define vision. I mean, how many places have gone out and said, we need a block schedule, and then later on sort of ask the teachers, you know, do you know what to do with 80 minutes or 60 minutes? You know, have you thought about, you know, you really need to do that in the reverse order, which is to say, what's your vision for instruction? And then how do we organize ourselves to achieve that vision? Now, I just want to pose another question to you. At your school or with your team, how many of you would strongly agree or strongly disagree with the phrase that our teachers and administrators share a common vision for teaching and learning? Which I would define as the fact, you know, if I came there as a new teacher, somebody would be able to say, guess what? This is what teaching and learning looks like in our school. So would you just respond to that? Okay, so we're tending to the agree side, but we've got a fair number of people that disagree with that statement. See, and I think that's a real critical question to ask yourself, because if you're thinking about developing a ninth grade academy or a small learning community or anything like that, I think it's more about the shared vision than it is the actual structural implications. See, I think that the first question you have to ask yourself is, have we forged that common vision? And then I think you move into some organizational thinking to support that vision. So I strongly encourage you, and I know we've done at the International Center, we've done some symposiums on reinventing high school, and I've had a chance to work with teams from all over the country on that question. But to me, it always comes down to that putting the cart before the horse there. No, the horse before the cart. Yeah, I got it now. Now, in terms of answering the question, why might you need a ninth grade academy, I just want to share with you kind of a case or a question. You know, what do you think a ninth grade academy could do for your school? Pick a couple choices here that you think might be two of the top things that a ninth grade academy might do for you. And again, you can vote twice on this one. Okay, I'm going to be spending, I think, a fair amount of time talking about this personal learning environment, the faculty teamwork, the student-centered learning. I think these are all important things. Curiously enough, in my experience developing a ninth grade academy, number 5 also proved to be one of the most powerful elements, yeah. Because, and I'll describe this more as I tell you the situation I was in. I was the assistant superintendent of schools in a district called East Irondequoit, which is outside Rochester, New York. And I think in our case, the ninth grade academy really proved that we could grow as a faculty administrative team. And that's probably the most powerful lesson that we learned, in addition to accomplishing some of those other things. Now, here's the website of the district, and I think it's in your handout. You can take a look. Just to give you an idea, we're up in Rochester, New York, up on the lake. And this particular district is on the north side of Rochester. This is the city of Rochester, which is, you know, a very industrialized city. This district had all the characteristics of sort of a semi-urbanized district. It was technically in the suburbs, but it looked and felt much more like the city than it did the surrounding suburbs. I mean, when you got out here, there was a much more affluent population. The demographics were quite different. Our school, our high school, had about 1,000 students, and this mix of demographics is actually trending towards students with greater needs economically. I mean, it's a district that actually has been transitioning and becoming much more reflective of the urban population, and some of the more outlying suburban districts are much more reflective of the suburban population. So in our particular case, we were facing some very low scores when I arrived there back in 2000 as assistant superintendent. And if you look at our vertical here on student achievement from low to high and understanding what improves student achievement moving out on the horizontal scale, when I got there, the school board said to me, your goal should be to raise scores. That's why we're bringing you here. And I said, well, you know what? I don't really agree with that goal. I don't think that's a good idea, because all you're really asking us to do is get lucky. I said, what we have to focus on is we have to focus on understanding what improves student performance. And it may take us some time to master those things, but eventually the scores will go up. And that's exactly what we did. And over the course of 5 years, our scores did go up. And I think the ninth grade academy was a critical component there, because it really demonstrated that our teachers and our administrative team could work together to, in a sense, reinvent the high school one grade at a time. And that's what we did, because each entering group of freshmen faced a very different environment that they had in the past. And over time, we went from a high school that I think was sort of characterized by mediocrity and not real challenging academic courses to a much more powerful academic setting. And the ninth grade academy was the catalyst for that. So that's part of what I'm going to be suggesting to you. Now, here's another question. At our school, we use data to determine what's working, as opposed to just doing things because we like to do them. Okay, kind of a split there. The experience when I got to the district is we were not using data. And there were a lot of myths floating around as to what kind of performance we had. For example, one of the things that was going on in this district is our elementary scores were pretty good, but then the scores started to drop off in middle school and high school, especially in middle school. And we had some myths in the district. And one of the myths was that we were losing our high-performing kids, that they were sticking around for the elementary program, and then when they got to middle school, they left. Another myth we had was it was the kids that were transferring in, you know, the city kids that were coming in that were pulling down our scores. And, of course, we all had the myth of, you know, what do you expect from these kids? They can't learn, you know. I mean, it was that kind of environment that I went into. And so one of the things I did is I began to look at data and share data with teachers and administrators. And, for example, back in 2001, I looked at the kids who failed the eighth grade ELA exam, and I just tried to answer a question. What year did they come into our district? 55% of them came in kindergarten. Of the kids that failed, over half. Another 14% were here since first through third grade. In other words, three quarters of the kids were not the new kids. It was our kids. And more importantly, I drilled down a little bit deeper and found that of the kids who failed to meet standards, 60% of them were regular ed, not economically disadvantaged, not ESSEL. In other words, part of what you have to do is you have to use data to decide what's really going on, as opposed to those kind of pictures in our heads that people tend to carry around. Now, as far as leadership and planning for this particular program, we had a great opportunity. Back in 2003, we took a 7-8 junior high that was an appendage of the high school, and we eliminated it with the development of a new 6-8 middle school. So that was sort of the catalyst. And starting the year before, I got together with our associate principal at the high school, and I said, how would you and a team of teachers like to develop a school within a school? Now, I was the assistant superintendent for instruction. So they recruited the teachers. They started meeting on a weekly basis. They got input from the site-based team. The teachers were very involved in the development of the curriculum and the program. This is Matt Laniak. If you want to email him, his address is in your handout. He was the associate principal and the founding director of the Ninth Grade Academy a few years back. By the way, he's now the principal of the entire high school. And the Ninth Grade Academy continues under the direct leadership of somebody else. And these are some of the comments, because I actually interviewed teachers to find out what they thought. And for example, you'll see in this comment a Ninth Grade Academy teacher talking about the opportunity to use data, the opportunity to align program with standards, and the real difference in terms of the way we're running this school. Or another teacher here talking about, you know, we got together for 2 years. Matt, again, the associate principal who was assigned specifically to this, really supporting them, and the idea that, you know, this was really put together with the hard work of the teachers, and it was all about collaboration, because that's really what this was. The teachers met on a weekly basis once the program got going. The real focus was that all the teachers would know all the kids and they would share a philosophy. It was all about a shared vision of instruction. As far as our curriculum, data, and instructional model, I will just pose a question to you. At our school, teachers consistently use a common set of learning strategies. To what extent do you agree with that? Is that your experience at your school? Teachers have a consistent use of learning strategies. They all use them. Okay, probably not. You know, as a classroom teacher for 25 years, I went in my room and I did my thing. And it wasn't because I was ornery. It was because I was never given an opportunity to plan with anybody else. And so one of the things that we did as a foundation of this school is we really asked the teachers what they thought would work. We did some surveys of teachers. We asked questions like regarding specific strategies, and the three questions we asked is, do we engage in this practice? How much would it impact student performance? And how feasible is it to implement? And we asked every teacher that question, and we started to drill down in terms of what our teachers thought would make the biggest difference. And of course, one of the things we came up with was it had a lot to do with literacy. Okay? It really was not so much about student attitude as much it was about kids' literacy skills. And so that became a real focus. All our teachers, all our content teachers, learned strategies to support literacy. We started using consistent approaches. If you've been in any of my other workshops over the last couple days, or yesterday and today, all the strategies that I sort of introduced there were the kinds of strategies that I worked with our teachers to really implement a common set of approaches. Now, as far as the program and the schedule and the facilities, which I really think comes after the vision of instruction, we had a physical space that included both dedicated space to the Ninth Grade Academy and some shared space. The dedicated space was essentially two halls. in one part of the high school. You came in a separate door. There was an administrator's office right there. There was a ninth grade academy counselor assigned to that section. There was a secretary. This was the freshman-only section. We also, because we had a big and a small gym, and the small gym was over there, that was the freshman academy gym. We also had a lot of shared areas. All the specials they went to in the rest of the building. Much too difficult to have freshman-only art class, music class. I mean, it just wasn't going to work. But that's a good thing, because they needed to mix in with some of the upperclassmen. Now, here's another question I'd pose to you. At our school, we have identified the gatekeeper courses that impact student academic progress. We've adjusted the program as needed. Do you know what's keeping your kids from graduating on time? Okay, we tending to the disagree side. We went in, we looked at the data, we designed a schedule primarily around math. Math was our gatekeeper. That's what was keeping kids from graduating on time. We scheduled a double math period with a morning session that was more in the traditional mode, an afternoon session for the kids to actually do the math thinking, the math application, for all our kids that had failed the Math 8. Just a quote from Doug Reeves, that after pregnancy, failure in Algebra 1 is the leading indicator of high school dropout rate. And curiously enough, the leading indicator of success in Algebra 1 is English 8. And as Doug Reeves says, it's a reading test with numbers. So we really hit that very hard. And one of the things that happened as a result is if you look at the kids who came out of Math 8 percent passing, who later went on to pass Algebra 1, we had a dramatic increase because we targeted that. In the past, we just kept teaching and reteaching math. We're making no progress at all. We had to change the way we did math instruction. So we made it into that double period. Curiously enough, some of the special teachers who initially said, well, wait a minute, if you're doubling up, then they're not going to have time to take the specials, we started showing them the data of how many kids were repeating math. And they were losing more kids to the specials because kids were back taking math a second and third time. Now, what I was very pleased with is when we then get to the Math B exam, which is in New York State, we got a Math A and a Math B, and Math B is the advanced math. Before the ninth grade academy in that high school, only 26% of the kids were passing Math B. Now that the cohort group has moved through the ninth grade academy, just this last year, the first cohort group, we have 66% of the kids passing Math B. Simply because we gave them the right foundation.
Do all the ninth graders, are they in the academy?
All the ninth graders are in the academy. But the only ones that are in this double math period are the kids that are struggling from grade 8. We also set more challenging goals for kids. I told you there was a kind of a lot of mediocrity in the building. We launched a more rigorous honors program. When I got there, we had a program that I would call honors light. You know, everyone was in honors. You know, it was easy. You know, I've always thought as a teacher that the A is the coward's B plus. You know, it's so easy to give kids a higher grade. You know, and one of the things that we had been doing in that school long before I got there is just telling everyone that they were great. So everyone was in honors. But when you looked at the data, the kids that progressed through honors, who actually took an AP, who actually sat for the AP test, and then who actually got a qualifying score, it was a line like that, straight down. So we instituted a more rigorous honors program. And initially, before the ninth grade academy, we had, this is level one kids, this is level two score on AP, this is a qualifying score of level three, here's level four, here's level five. You'll see that we only had 38% of the kids getting a qualifying score on AP. Now, we ended up with slightly more kids, but now 65% of the kids were getting a qualifying score on AP. Or to look at the data in a slightly different graph here, you'll see the difference. So by using the Ninth Grade Academy as an opportunity to say, this is what honors work looks like starting in the ninth grade. We're not just going to tell you you're doing great for the heck of it. This is the level work that you have to do. Again, we use the Ninth Grade Academy as a change agent for the entire high school. We didn't have to change every grade, just focused on one at a time. You had a question?
Increased summer prerequisite work on that last
one. Yes.
What's that?
Well, one of the things that, of course, because we had Honors Light before, we didn't do a lot of work. But now we had a prerequisite. We had objective criteria for getting in. There was work that was done in the summer ahead of time to be in Honors. We also did not want Honors to be a train that you missed at the station you could never get on again. So there were always opportunities for kids to get into Honors levels later on in their high school career. It also didn't mean that because you were in there, you stayed. Okay? In other words, you had to work hard to stay there. Another thing we started doing is a much more intensive tracking of student progress. Getting in, as I said, looking at the gatekeeper courses, tracking kids. I used to meet a couple times a year with the principal, with the counselor, that's me, the ASI. We identified the gatekeeper courses, etc. Back in 1999, our high school had the lowest graduation rate in the county. In 2005, we had the highest. Again, not only using that Ninth Grade Academy model, but just working as a team, trying to find out what's keeping our kids behind. And again, engaging the faculty and looking at that data. And of course, personalizing your relationship with the kids is really critical. That's what a small learning community is all about. I remember going out with my camera one day to take some pictures of the kids. Of course, immediately they start hamming it up in the hallways. But question I would put to you, if you pick two challenges to the student-centered classroom, what would you say are the two biggest challenges? Time, demands of testing, etc. Oh, this should say lack of student-centered lessons. Sorry. There should be the word lessons there. It got dropped off. So what do you think is holding back a student-centered classroom? Okay, I'm going to bring this one in. It's interesting, a lot of you picked expectations. I think we, in one way or another, tried to address all of these elements, but I'm going to talk a little bit about expectations next, and I'm sort of glad that that came up towards the top of the list. We had a lot of kids that were coming. The tradition was kids just didn't do their homework. Kids didn't care if they passed the class. You know, I'll take it again. Who cares? We set very clear and very high expectations among the teachers. We were consistent. You know, they didn't get the playoff. Well, so-and-so doesn't make me do this. We all followed the same rules. In your handout here, I've got some of our non-negotiable expectations. I'm not going to read these for you, but you can take a look at your leisure. But essentially, every teacher followed the same set of high expectations among all the kids. And guess what happened? They did it. It was as simple as that. Because the teachers were working together as a team, we kind of put kids in the driver's seat. They became responsible for their own learning. No excuses. We engaged our parents as partners on this one. We made it very clear what we expected, and over time, that's exactly what the kids did. We shifted the responsibility of learning over to the students. We used consistent strategies, no excuses, and you know what? If you ask more of kids, they'll do it. It's as simple as that. Yeah?
How do you manage the special ed students who gets an IEP that's rearranged for every other assignment?
Well, that's yeah. Could I do a whole other presentation on that? I'll tell you what, I'll answer those questions later because those really take a while. But it's an excellent question about the special ed population. Yeah, question.
So what happens when kids did come without their homework?
Well, what we did initially, that's a very good question. I can answer that quickly. We set up second shadow classes for the various sessions. We found another teacher who was available, and if you showed up, for example, to math class and you didn't have your work done, we said, guess what? You're not ready to participate in today's class. So you're going to go next door where Mrs. So-and-so will be with you, and you won't be with your friends. And at first the kids, you're kidding. I don't want to do that. And you know what? They started showing up with their work done. And before long, we didn't even have to man. We just put them in another classroom. Now, you know, if some parent would have pressed us on it, is this legitimate instruction for my kids? You know, we probably would have been caught in a tight spot. But you know what? It just stopped. Yeah. We followed the rigor and relevance model, and I don't want to spend a lot of time with that because I've been doing that in some of the other sessions, and I think most of you have been through that one. But we really shifted out into the other quadrants, away from the A quadrant where the teachers are doing all the work. An interesting thing that happened, after 3 years of the ninth grade academy, our long-term suspensions in the building dropped from 43 to 10. This is some recent data I just got from Matt from this past year. So this had an impact not only academically, but over time in the climate. How do we connect with our parents? Well, you know, I guess I could pose the question here, which is going to come up. At our school, our parents have been effectively engaged as partners. What's your level of agreement with that question, statement? Well, that's the experience we had because, you know what, we were told our parents don't care. That was another one of our myths. You know, our parents don't really care about school. I mean, our population of parents was not highly educated. They had not had a great academic experiences. So we kind of not only blamed our kids, but we blamed the parents. What I did is I developed a survey for the parents. This is available on my website if you want to go get it. But it was a parent involvement survey, and we administered it to all the parents. We looked at multiple ways to get it out to them to actually find out from them how they wanted to be interacted with. Because guess what? We kept doing the same curriculum nights, and they weren't showing up for them, and we had to do something different. So we really modified our approach. And before long, you know, we had a parent training program. We had a parent university, how to discipline with dignity, how to create a learning environment at home. We had a new website. We had emails going out to parents. We redesigned them into family curriculum nights. I mean, we had to change. I mean, if we were a business, we'd have been out of business because no one was showing up. So we had to remarket ourselves, and that's exactly what we did based on the data. We made presentations to the eighth graders coming up. We had an academic pledge of support. As this comment said here, one of the teachers said that we, you know, it's all about responsibility and students fulfilling that, and we really got that message out to our parents. And you know what we found out? If you talk to our teachers, they say, guess what? Handled the right way, our parents backed us on everything. So instead of coming into battle as to why their kid was suspended or why they were being dropped for class, now they were helping their kids understand why they should meet the expectations that we were setting for them in school. Recruiting and supporting teachers. Well, here's a question. At our school, staff development effectively models good instruction as opposed to sit and get. So would you say that your staff development program effectively models good instruction? Okay, kind of mixed there. We felt that we could not expect instruction in our classroom to look any better than the staff development model. And if our staff development was coming in, putting in seat time, that wasn't what we wanted to see teachers doing. So if we say that you have to have multiple learning styles for kids, there's multiple learning styles for teachers. I mean, you name it, we modeled it with our faculty. And we also worked on staff assignments. I sat down, from my part of the world, teachers' unions are very strong. And so long before this got going, I sat down with the union leadership and I said, listen, this cannot be a seniority assignment for Ninth Grade Academy. We really have to find a way to get the right people there. We worked through all that. We recruited our Ninth Grade Academy teachers. Again, we had a counselor. We went through training. Both the principal and myself would do walkthroughs of the classrooms. We had a lot of dialogue, a lot of action study groups among teachers as to what was working. Again, we tried to make it a learning laboratory. We had a summer academy model where we merged staff development with intensive work for at-risk kids. So basically in the afternoons, the faculty was being paid for staff development. The next morning, the kids were in and they were utilizing the strategies with the kids. We got to merge some Title I and Title III funds. I mean, we mixed and matched all kinds of monies to support this, and it proved to be very cost effective for us. But in the end, I really have to hand a lot of credit to Matt Laniak, who was the administrator. You've got to have a dedicated administrator that's in the classrooms, that's in the hallways, because that's what's really going to make it work. Matt certainly did that. I think one of the most powerful things that I learned from this was what a transforming experience it was for our teachers. Many of the teachers in the Ninth Grade Academy had been kind of going at it 5, 6, 10 years. Some of them were kind of disillusioned. Many of them said they're a better teacher as a result of having been part of the Ninth Grade Academy. Now, what I'd like to do, oh, by the way, I want these back. But I was going to show you, this is a 10-minute video that we're going to take a look at. And I guess if anyone is so worried about the lunch line that they want to leave, just leave the clicker there and take off. But for the rest of you, this literally takes no more than 10 minutes. So I've just got to get this set up here. And what I did interviews with teachers from the Ninth Grade Academy and with students, and we turned it into a little 10-minute DVD. You can go to the website and actually watch this online. So if you want to share it with others, you can do that. Just gonna put that there. And put this here. And then can you hear that all right?
This academy was started basically with no budget and just a bunch of people that wanted to see a little bit of change for the ninth grade students. And all it requires is and being on the same page, sharing a common philosophy, and you can make great things happen.
And I came down to the Ninth Grade Academy at its beginning. I really believed in the philosophy of the Ninth Grade Academy and our administrator in the Ninth Grade Academy. And I believe that's why it works so well down here, is because all the teachers are on the same page in terms of our expectations.